first of all, Scott, the Western media, as you know, has consistently portrayed this war so far as a Ukrainian victory. I find that to be amazing, given that you and most people in alternative media are consistently calling it a Russian victory. So can you just first tell us who is winning this war and why do you think that?
Well, it's hands down. Russia is winning. Russia will win. Russia has already won. This was never in doubt. Ukraine never had a chance. The perception of Ukraine, putting up, a defense capable of beating Russia was created from two separate threads, so to speak. One is the Russians themselves. Understand that Russia didn't call this the invasion of Ukraine. Russia didn't call this a military operation. Russia called this a special military operation, which means that it deviates from the norms and standards one would normally associate with a military operation. Doctrinally, this is very important. When Russia goes to war in modern, large-scale combined arms operations like what we're seeing in Ukraine, from a doctrinal standpoint, they bring two things. One, overwhelming firepower. Russia has not just superiority in artillery, but supremacy in artillery compared to not just Ukraine, but any other nation that they'll fight. Artillery is the heart and soul of the way Russia fights a war. They will overwhelm you with firepower, which unfortunately is a copacetic way of saying they're going to kill you. If you're in front of them, their artillery will smother you with high explosive, and whatever's left then will have to deal with the second part, which is mass. Russia masses armor and armored fighting vehicles, and then they basically punch a hole through the area that they just bombarded, and they penetrate deep into your rear area. They annihilate your logistics, your command and control. They roll up the flanks of your defenders. That's the way the Russians fight. Very bloody, very brutal, very methodical. That's not how they started this war. This war was started with a very soft approach. Russia went out of its way to say that it does not want to inflict any harm on the Ukrainian civilians, and it wants to minimize the impact that this special military operation will have on Ukrainian civil infrastructure. Now, this was the goal. A Russian general early on in this conflict called it the Syrian touch. Now, the Western media goes, wait a minute, doesn't that mean you're blowing Aleppo up and you're annihilating? No, that's what ignorant people say. People who have studied Russia and know Russia and studied history. I mean, it's not a matter of just study what Russia did in Syria. Russia worked with the Syrian army to surround urban areas where jihadists were located. And then they confronted the jihadists with the inevitability of their demise. And they said, rather than us coming in and blowing up every building and killing everybody in here, why don't we bring in some buses and let you get on these buses? And then we'll evacuate so that we reduce the impact. And this happened over and over and over again. The Russian military police became experts at negotiating a ceasefire between the Syrian army and the jihadists, and then coordinating the humanitarian evacuation of not just the fighters, but their families, and taking them up to Idlib in northern Syria. This was a Syrian touch, and that was the approach that the Russians said they were going to take in Ukraine, to come in soft and give the Ukrainians the opportunity to choose nonviolence as the means of resolving this issue. Russia said it's inevitable. They will denazify. They have we can talk about this later, but they have a thing for the Nazis. There will be no tolerance. That odious ideology will be annihilated. And the demilitarization, which means that the Ukrainian military that since 2015 has been trained as a de facto proxy of NATO, will be taken apart. Russia will no longer allow a NATO proxy to exist on its soil. Russia have been led to believe that they were going to be greeted by the Russian-speaking population, and that many of the Ukrainian officers were going to remain in their barracks. They were led to believe this by the work of their the Fifth Department of the FSB, which is the group that does intelligence in Ukraine. 150 of their officers were just arrested by the Russian government for getting it wrong. Apparently, for whatever reason, whether they were corrupt, whether they were incompetent, whether it was a combination of the two, their guarantees of a peaceful Ukrainian civilian population and a compliant Ukrainian military were dead wrong. The Russians, instead of being welcomed, were resisted from the start. The Ukrainian military, rather than staying in its barracks, chose to fight. And I'll say this about the Ukrainian military. You could be critical all you want of them and their ideology, but they're professional, they're well-equipped, they're well-trained, they're well-led, and they fight like demons. And they're, you know, it's the second largest army in Europe. Just keep that in mind. Well, the first largest army, of course, is Russia. But the second largest army in Europe is Ukraine. This isn't a small, pathetic little force. We're talking about 260,000 regular forces equipped with thousands of tanks, thousands of fighting vehicles, thousands of artillery pieces, trained to NATO standards, with modern communications equipment, fighting on their own soil, their own homeland. They know Ukraine like the back of their hands, literally. They also have upwards of an additional 400, 500,000 reservists and territorial militias. So, you know, we're talking close to a million men under arms, a million men under arms. So anybody who thinks that this is tiny little Ukraine being rolled over by the large Russian army, the Russians came to play with 200,000 troops. Now, normally, basic military math, if you're doing offensive operations, you want a 3-to-1 advantage. For every one defender, you want three attackers. The Russians are coming at it with the exact opposite. For every one attacker, there's three defenders. And you'll say, well, how can they do this? Because the Russians, in their phase one operation, focused not on territorial acquisition, but on shaping the battlefield.
Right.
The most important thing for the Russians is to isolate and destroy the 60 to 80,000 Ukrainian troops that are in the Donbas region, threatening the Russian-speaking provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk, which we have to remember for the past 8 years have been bombarded on a daily basis with 14,000 people being killed. One of the main reasons why Russia is carrying out this special military operation is because of this 8 years of bombardment. But the Russians realized going in that if they focused on just defeating these 60,000, that you had the rest of that very large Ukrainian army I just told you about going to come down and get in the way and possibly set the Russians up for defeat. So the Russians needed to shape the battlefield. You do that by fixing those 60,000 troops in place with limited frontal assaults carried out by the Luhansk and Donetsk people's militias with Russian army support. You do a military feint coming down from the north out of Belarus towards Kiev.
Right.
Everybody's like, no, they tried to capture Kiev. No, they didn't. How do 50,000 men capture a city of 3.1 million? Can't happen, won't happen, will never happen. No military professional will tell you, yes, that's plausible. What they can do is threaten to surround it and thereby fix the Ukrainian forces in place there and divert reinforcements that otherwise would have gone to Donbass, divert them up to Kiev. And that was the purpose of what the Russians were doing. And even the Ukrainian military says that's what they did, and they were very effective at it. They didn't suffer a defeat in Kiev. They came down. They carried out a very forceful demonstration. Understand, a demonstration attack has to be convincing, which means you have to fight. And you're fighting on terrain that is into the advantage of the Ukrainians, and the Russians suffered losses. But they were always going to suffer losses when you carry out a convincing feint. If the Ukrainians don't believe that what you're doing is real, they're not going to divert their forces to it. They have to buy into the notion that you're trying to surround Kiev. In order to do that, you have to attack, even when it's not to your advantage to attack. So the Russians suffered some setbacks there. Tactically, but operationally and strategically, Kiev was a great victory for Russia because it achieved what they wanted to achieve. The same thing with floating the ships off of the coast of Odessa. The Ukrainians believed that the Russians might carry out an amphibious attack on Odessa. So they kept their considerable forces in place in Odessa, and they reinforced them. This freed up the Russians to do what their primary objective was on phase one, which was to create a land bridge between Crimea and Russia. Central to that land bridge is the city of Mariupol. Mariupol, of course, is defended by, you know, the Ukrainian Marines, very elite forces, and also the Azov Regiment, a neo-Nazi unit of some infamy. So we shall say these two units decided that they were going to fight street to street. And so Mariupol has been destroyed as a result. People say, oh, it's a war crime. It's not a war crime. When the Ukrainians made the decision to put a tank next to a hospital, that hospital is no longer a hospital. It's a military target. When they dug into residential areas, those residential areas became a military target. The Russians worked with the Ukrainian government and the international humanitarian groups to create so-called humanitarian corridors to evacuate as many people as possible. But the Azov regiment opted to keep over 150,000 Ukrainians in place, holding them hostage. They became human shields, the belief being that Russia wouldn't bomb a neighborhood that had a lot of civilians. And they were right. What the Russians did is come in and fight very brutal house-to-house combat to clear the Nazis out. Now they have the Nazis cornered in the Azov steel factory, and I think we're looking at the last hours of their existence. They were given an opportunity to surrender. They opted to fight, and the Russians are obliging their desire to die in the cause of Ukraine. But now that you've cleared this land corridor, the Russians now have shaped the battlefield to their advantage. Now they're going to bring their forces down, and they're going to carry out what's called a double envelopment. You're going to come in from the south, come in from the north, and you're going to surround the Ukrainian forces that have been fixed in place in the Donbass. This, again, if it was doctrinally, this would take place very quickly. Russia would overwhelm them with artillery and then punch through with armor. But as Putin, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, said the other last week, he said, I know there's people that want us to go faster, but we're fighting on our timetable, not theirs. He said, this is going to be a very literate campaign. What he meant by that is by the book. They're going by the book, slowly but surely. The goal to maximize the enemy casualties with minimum impact on civilian infrastructure and the lowest possible casualties on the part of the Russians. So they go slow, they go sure, they overwhelm with artillery where necessary, they close with infantry and armor where that's provided. And the end result, usually, unfortunately, is the end of the day, every day a couple hundred more Ukrainians are dead. Maybe one or two Russians are dead, and then they move on to the next day. And that kind of exchange ratio, the Ukrainians can't match. Today, their military is depleted. Their command and control is virtually non-existent. Their logistics is wiped out. There's no more fuel. There's no more ammunition. There's no more vehicles to maneuver. And I think we're going to see in the next days and weeks the total collapse of the Ukrainian army.
Well, now, you're saying that Putin has undertaken a very restrained strategy here, very restrained approach to this war. Why? Is it because he's a nice guy?
Well, I'm not going to comment on him. Nice guy, bad guy. He's a professional. He's a Russian patriot who recognizes that the Ukrainians are Slavic brothers. This isn't Russia going to war against Nazi Germany. This isn't Russia going to war against Finland, and I use that name on purpose because the Finns should be paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine right now and understand that if they keep pushing for NATO membership, this too could be their future. We'll get into that if you want to, but these are Slavs. These are Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. These are brother Slavs. This is almost like a civil war without the hatred on the part of Russia's side. They don't have animosity to the Ukrainian people. They don't have animosity toward the Ukrainian army. So their goal wasn't going in to destroy Ukraine. You destroy the land of an enemy. You preserve the land of a friend. And they view the Ukrainian people as their friends, as their brothers, as their cousins. They have a problem with the government. They have a problem with the military that became a NATO proxy. And they have a huge problem with the neo-Nazi ideology. I mean, I think most Americans, you know, we poo-poo that. We go, ah, come on, they're not real Nazis. They're just a couple of them. It's not a big deal. First of all, there's more than a couple of them, and it is a big deal. Imagine if you would, you know, being in the U.S. military and someone came up to you and said, well, the American military is a racist organization. No, it isn't. We let everybody in. But what if the KKK had a militia down in Alabama? And overnight, the U.S. government went, well, why don't you guys organize that militia up and we're going to make you a formal, we're going to incorporate you into the U.S. Army intact. The KKK battalion. Boom. And then you can become the KKK regiment. You can bring in all your brother KKK guys and you're going to be a unit and we're going to put you on the border and you're going to represent our country enforcing the border. Now, is the American military a racist military? Yes, indeed, because it has incorporated and tolerated the most racist unit possible. Is the United States of America a racist country? Yes, because we have incorporated and tolerated racist military units intact. We've mainstreamed them. We've legitimized them. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Ukraine has done with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. They've taken Nazi units. They've brought them in and made them part of the army. And then they've given them frontline positions of authority on the battlefield. And they've taken their officers and imbued them throughout the Ukrainian military. The Nazis run Ukraine. It's as simple as that. Now, again, people say, well, wait a minute, they're a minority. How can that happen? Well, let's talk about Russian history for a second. You know, there was two groups that emerged from the revolution, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. Mensheviks means small. Bolsheviks mean big. But the reality was the Mensheviks were the biggest party. The Bolsheviks, the smallest party. Why did the Bolsheviks win? Because they were violent. The Bolsheviks came in and they killed. They arrested. They beat up. They used violence to seize control. So a minority took control and defined the entire early years of the Soviet Union. The Nazis are a minority, but they're violent. And they come in and they intimidate. They intimidated Viktor Poroshenko. The president before Zelensky, they told him if he didn't pass their legislation, if he didn't push their legislation through parliament, they would mini-Maidan him. Maidan being the violent revolution that mainstreamed these Nazis in 2014. They actually ransacked his office and threatened to drag him out and run him through the streets. Normally, you call that an insurrection. But that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Zelensky. They told Zelensky that if he signed the Minsk agreements creating a ceasefire, that they would hang him by the neck until dead on the main street of Kiev, the capital. Not this wasn't a secret thing that they did. They made a video and broadcast it. So the Azov battalion, the Nazis, run Ukraine. They run every aspect of Ukraine. This is why Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian nationalist who fought side by side with Adolf Hitler during World War II, whose gunmen were the guys who pulled the trigger on the 30,000 Jews at Babi Yar. His gunmen were the guys who guarded concentration camps. His gunmen were responsible for the deaths of 100,000 Poles and 200,000 Russians, civilians. He's now the hero of Ukraine. They say, well, it's just nationalism. Really? Well, what if I put up a statue of Adolf Hitler in Germany? And said, don't worry about it. I'm not supporting Nazis. It's just German nationalism that I'm supporting. No, it doesn't fly. It doesn't fly with Hitler in Germany. It doesn't fly with Bandera in Ukraine. But they put up a statue. They have a national holiday. He's the national hero. They paint streets after him. They put up monuments to the Waffen SS units where the Ukrainian nationalists fight. They have parades where the Azov battalion put on Nazi uniforms and march down the street with their hands up in the air. They have swastikas tattooed on their. The Nazis run Ukraine. That's just the reality of it.
Wow. I have to say, I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence of their actual ideology, the Azov regiment. I've seen lots of insignias, which are linked to the Nazis for sure on their uniforms, etc. But I haven't heard them talk. I haven't seen much discourse from them that I could identify as Nazi or fascist or anything. Can you tell me a little bit more about what the evidence is besides Bandera and what he represents?
Well, a key aspect to this kind of virulent nationalism is the concept of ethnic purity.
Okay.
The Ukrainian nationalists believe in an ethnically pure Ukraine. Now, where have we heard this before?
Mm-hmm.
Nazi Germany, Aryan nation, ethnically pure Germans. So they view the Poles as subhuman. That's why they target the Poles for elimination. They view the Russians as subhuman. They call them orcs. And if you haven't seen the evidence, go take a look at the Russian speakers that they arrest and saran wrap to a pole, pull their pants down, molest them in public, paint their face green. And it's happened over and over and over again today, right now, as we speak. That's what the nationalists do. The term they use, glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes, dates back to World War II, to the Banderists. And it's about, Ukrainian purity. And that's the biggest thing. It's the expression of Ukrainian nationalism as a racially pure, homogeneous people that views anybody who's not Ukrainian as subhuman.
Okay, so they don't believe in like the Slavic Brotherhood, I guess.
No.
Okay.
No, they view the Russians as ethnically impure, and they call them orcs out of J.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Fairly persuasive and fairly troubling. So the West is the Western media is lying about that, and they're also apparently, according to you, lying about the basic fact of who's winning the war. Why? And this is very important, and all sorts of politics behind this. Why is the West portraying this war as a Ukrainian victory? Why are they lying about that?
Well, let's start off with the media's inability to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We know that prior to the Russian special military operation beginning, that the media had started to report on the Nazi threat coming out of Ukraine. Magazines like the Atlantic magazine, Atlantic Monthly, said, Ukraine's got a Nazi problem. The New York Times ran front page stories about the Nazis and how much of a problem this is. U.S. Congress, when the U.S. military would go over and train the Ukrainian military, the U.S. Congress was looking at photographs of U.S. servicemen training a Azov battalion person who had a swastika. And they said, whoa, time out. You can't do that. So they passed legislation that said you can't train the Nazis because it was problematic. That all went away when Russia started massing its troops. It's as though we forgot there was a Nazi problem. We minimized it. It suddenly was just this minority. It wasn't a big deal. So the West convinced itself to lie about the reality of the Nazi problem in Ukraine. They know what the truth is, but that truth is inconvenient with the new mission of elevating Ukraine to a cause worthy of American support. And what is that cause? That cause is going against Vladimir Putin. Notice I didn't say going against Russia,
right?
Because the media doesn't. I will say that there's literally no Russian experts on mainstream media today. None. you have anti-Putin experts, people who hate Putin, but you don't have anybody who can actually converse intelligently about the reality of Russia. And if you're treating this nation of 160 million people as the personification of one man, your ignorance is being worn on your sleeve. Vladimir Putin is the elected president of Russia. Now, he's been elected for many, many terms. He's been around for 22 years. Some people will say that's a dictatorship. Dictators don't win presidential elections by 54%. Dictators tend to win presidential elections by 98%, 99%. Oh, right. 54% is a little too close for comfort because Russia is a democracy. It's not a perfect democracy, but one of the reasons why it lacks perfection is that the United States has corrupted the political opposition by buying them, by forming them to support their own policy of regime change. Now, people say, wait a minute, Biden may have said that, but we know he didn't mean it. That's not the American policy because they said so. Ask yourself this. What was the reset of the Obama administration? You remember 2009, a nice little red button misspelled, Hillary Clinton and Sergey Lavrov pushing it and laughing and chuckling and chortling. That was a policy of regime change. We were trying to empower the sitting president, Dmitry Medvedev, who had done a cute little constitutional swap with Putin in 2008, where Putin became prime minister, Medvedev became president, because the Constitution of Russia only allowed Putin to serve two consecutive terms, but he could come back for a third. We decided, the United States, that we were going to empower Medvedev to become the new Boris Yeltsin. That is a weak, compliant leader who would do whatever we wanted to do so we could economically exploit Russia and keep Russia weak. And we put pressure on. We tried to bribe Medvedev. We promised him things with arms control and missile defense and all this. It was so bad that in March of 2011, Vice President Biden at the time under Obama, who had the Ukrainian portfolio, flew to Moscow, and he met with the opposition, ones that we bought and paid for. And he said, Vladimir Putin shouldn't consider running for president again. It would be bad for him and bad for Russia. Sounds like a threat. Sounds like one of those mafia, you know, I'm making him an offer he can't refuse kind of thing. It's regime change. We didn't want Vladimir Putin to be in office because Vladimir Putin was the opposite of Boris Yeltsin, a strong leader who wanted to have Russia take care of Russia first, not bow to the United States, not cave into NATO, not allow Western companies to come and economically exploit Russia's resources. And Putin came back into power. And ever since then, we've been demonizing him. We've been saying that he is the personification of evil. He's all that's wrong with Russia. He's a dictator. He's an autocrat. All the things that he's not. But the people that are saying this are people who never studied Russia. They studied Russian exploitation. What I mean by that is these are the people that were educated in the late 1980s and 1990s. They got their PhDs about, you know, how to exploit Russia. People like Michael McFaul, mm-hmm. who became a U.S. ambassador, senior advisor, the architect of the reset. People like Fiona Hill and others. If you go back, one thing they all have in common is they wrote PhDs that attacked Putin as a dictator. It's almost as if they had the same paper. They just removed the cover and put on a cover sheet with a new name, and they just run it through a PhD paper mill. And they all said the same thing, that Vladimir Putin is a dictator, an autocrat, and they defined Russia in the person of Vladimir Putin. This is wrong. This is ignorant. That's not what it is. But that's why we have the media has bought into this. I mean, how else can you explain, William Browder? You know, Mr. Hermitage, he was of the class that went in and economically exploited Russia. He went in there and took advantage of loose Russian tax laws, loose Russian laws to create the $250 billion hedge fund. How do you do that? You can only do that if you yourself are corrupt and you are, you know, playing a footloose and fancy free game. The Russians finally called him on it. Just like Vladimir Putin called in all the oligarchs. And as soon as he became president, said, you can't get involved in politics. You have to play a clean game. They said the same thing to people like Browder. Browder wouldn't play a clean game. So he was made persona non grata and his hedge fund broken up. His lawyer, who's not a lawyer, by the way, Magnitsky, was arrested, died in prison. And as a result, we have the Magnitsky Act, which imposes sanctions and restrictions on Russia. But Browder has been shown to be a liar. Nobody believes any aspect of his story. And yet, because now that Vladimir Putin is the enemy, Browder is now brought back into mainstream TV as if he is a Russia expert. He's brought in to explain Russia. He is a common criminal. He's a man who stole from the Russians, robbed them blind, violated their tax laws. And now he's explaining the Russian soul, I guess, to the American people. That's the absurdity of this position. Masha Gessen, Gessen. She writes for the New Yorker. And I'm going to say some things, and it's not reflective of me. I'm an American, which means you are what you are, and I respect you for it. You can be left, right. You can be gay, straight. I don't care. As long as you're take that oath to the Constitution, I'm on your side. Unfortunately, in Russia, it's their own country, and homosexuals are not viewed in the same way. And Masha Gessen is a homosexual, active, in-your-face lesbian. She was also a very prominent journalist, and she ran afoul of Russia because of their homosexuality laws. Mm-hmm. And she resigned. Putin actually tried to bring her back. You know, he was like, I understand, you know, I know what's going on is wrong. I'd like you to come back. She refused and she left. She's in the United States now. And she attacks Russia. Well, she has every right to do. But understand that she is a single issue person. So she has defined Russia through its laws and actions targeting homosexuals. Mm-hmm. That's not how you define Russia. I mean, that's one aspect of Russia, mm-hmm. but that's not how you define it. And if you choose to define it that way, then it's going to taint every aspect of your analysis. And yet she's being mainstream. Anne Applebaum.
Yeah.
She, I think she's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Mm-hmm. Her husband also is a right wing Polish diplomat who has some questionable political beliefs. Mm-hmm. But she is now being mainstreamed when otherwise she should be marginalized. They're bringing in the most radical anti-Putin elements and mainstreaming them on the media to explain Russia to the American people, but they're not explaining Russia. They're simply articulating why they hate Vladimir Putin. And so the media is just the echo chamber for this. But the beauty of it is Russia doesn't care. Hmm. Putin is not losing one night's sleep because of what the West say, because it doesn't matter. And one reason why it doesn't matter is that we opted to go through the great economic divorce, the sanctions. You know, the one leverage we had on the Russians was that 20 to 30% of the economy was inextricably linked to the West through economic relations. And so we could always pressure them on the margins. Not now. We divorced. We broke. They didn't break. We broke. And Russia is saying, thank you. It's the most liberating moment in our life. Take a look at the Russian economy right now. Biden said, I crashed the ruble. No, he didn't. Harder now than it was before the invasion. The stock market collapsed. No. It's all green arrows going up.
That's right.
The Russian people are suffering. Actually, their shelves are full. It may not be brand name Western stuff, but they're not wanting. They're not lacking. They're there. Is it hurting them? Yeah. Anytime you make this kind of transition, it's inconvenient. Are there economic hiccups? Sure. There's a higher inflation rate than normal, but it's all being brought under control because the Russians have a plan. Because Joe Biden told Putin he was going to do this back in June 2021 when they met in Geneva. So Putin had months to come up with a plan. Guess who doesn't have a plan? The West. We promised these sanctions thinking that Russia would never, ever take it to the limit, that we'd never have to implement these because they'd be so horrible. I mean, these are massive sanctions. I mean, whatever term you wanted to throw on there, we threw on there. Newsflash. Vladimir Putin doesn't bluff. There's no bluff in him. He's not prone to hyperbole. He doesn't throw out irresponsible threats. But when he says something, the wise man would take it to the bank because it's going to happen. Hmm. And he said, if you ignore my diplomatic outreach in December 2021, I will invade Ukraine. We ignored his diplomatic outreach. He invaded Ukraine. And now we were stuck going, I guess we have to sanction him. But Germany went, all right, but Joe, you told me when I was visiting you that you had some liquid natural gas that you could bring over here. Oh, yeah, no, we don't have any liquid natural gas we can bring to you. We got nothing. Your economy is going to collapse. The French economy is going to collapse. The European economy is going to collapse. That's the reality. As bad as this hurts Russia, it's hurting Europe more because Joe Biden didn't have a plan, because Joe Biden didn't treat Russia seriously, because Joe Biden bought into the cartoonish caricature of Russia as a nation ruled by one man, Vladimir Putin, whom we're not even getting right. We call him corrupt. He's the least corrupted politician in Europe today. We call him irrational. There's nothing impulsive about Putin. Everything he does is planned very carefully, with the consequences thought out well in advance. That's why he has a plan, because he thought out the consequences well in advance.
In recent years, many people on the left have come to oppose gun control, seeing that historically, it has been used to control and subjugate oppressed minorities. The very first act of the Ku Klux Klan, in fact, was to disarm ex-slaves. And that's why we now have the John Brown Gun Club, the Sylvia Rivera Gun Club, named after one of the heroes of the Stonewall Riots, the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, the Pink Pistols and LGBTQ Gun Club, and the Socialist Rifle Association. Now, they understand that people having the ability to make their own guns is the greatest threat to any ruling class, and that 3D printed firearms make it nearly impossible for any government to completely control us. If they haven't already, members of these groups should purchase Ghost Gunner 3, which makes the world's first 0% receiver. Now, this year, the ATF will attempt to ban the purchase of unserialized 80% lower receivers, believing that this will stop the production of 3D printed guns. But Defense Distributed, the makers of Ghost Gunner CNC Mills, has an answer with Ghost Gunner 3. The Ghost Gunner 3 0% kit allows you to mill a complete mil-spec and unregistered AR-15 receiver from an unformed block of aluminum. This is performed automatically using Defense Distributed's new Ghost Gunner 3 CNC mill, meaning that you can make an AR 0% receiver today, no machining experience necessary, in the privacy of your own home. Very soon, Ghost Gunner's 0% receiver will become the only legal and affordable method of making an unregistered metal lower. The age of 80% is ending. The age of zero has begun. Go to ghostgunner.net to purchase the 0% starter kit or the 0% lower build kit. Again, that's ghostgunner.net, where the people will always have the ability, not just the right, to defend themselves. Why is Putin completely unacceptable to the foreign policy establishment in this country? I have said for a while now that hardly anyone knows anything about Putin in this country, but all of them hate him and all of them run the foreign policy of this country. So why is that? What is it about him that they find to be absolutely unacceptable, that they must remove him?
When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, 1991, 1992, the United States declared victory. I mean, we said we won, and then we proceeded to spend the decade of the 90s taking the former Soviet Union apart, either expanding NATO into the former Eastern Bloc countries or economically dissecting Russia, taking the valuable pieces for our own and leaving Russia with the rusted scraps. And for us, this was good because it was an unequal relationship. We no longer had a Soviet threat or a Russian threat we had to worry about, so we could begin the great restructuring of NATO. We could have the peace dividend here at home. Basically, we reframed the rules-based international order on the predicate of a defeated Russia. Vladimir Putin decided he's not going to play that game.
Right.
When he was handpicked by Boris Yeltsin to take over in 1999, one of the first things he said is, I'm looking out for Russia. I mean, remember that famous speech he gave where he said the greatest geopolitical disaster of the last century was the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Everyone went, oh, he wants a new Soviet Union. No, because there's a part two of that speech, which is because overnight, tens of millions of Russians became homeless.
Right.
And it's my job as the Russian president to look out for the interests of all the Russian people. And you do that by taking control of your economy. You do that by kicking out bad influence. You can't allow nations to come in and have majority stock ownership of your oil and gas resources. That can't happen. But that was happening. You can't allow people to just take all the wealth out of Russia, which is what the oligarchs were doing on behalf of the West. He had to reverse that. So he called the oligarchs in. He said, the money you have, you get to keep. But from now on, you play it clean when it comes to the Russian government and the business you do with the Russian government. You look out for the Russian people and you stay out of politics. If you can do that, you can stay here. Well, some of them couldn't. Some of them left and some tried to get involved in politics and got arrested and had their oil conglomerate taken over by the state. But by and large, he brought the oligarchs under control. And in doing so, he diminished Western economic control of Russia. And that's why everybody's mad. Because now we have to deal with Russia as an adult. Nobody wants to deal with Russia as an adult. That wasn't ever the plan. Russia was always going to be the sick child. that we could abuse, like we did with Boris Yeltsin. There is so much anger and resentment in the West towards Vladimir Putin because he flipped the script. He changed the narrative, and nobody wanted that narrative. Nobody wanted to deal with a strong Russia again. Nobody wanted to deal with a Russia that would look out for its own interests. Nobody wanted to compete with Russian energy. We wanted to own Russian energy, but we didn't want to compete with Russian energy. Everything Putin did to make Russia a stronger, more self-sufficient, respected nation on the world stage ran counter to the narrative that was being pursued by the United States and Western Europe. So that's why there's so much hatred and resentment towards Putin. Now, if you knew Russia, studied Russia, you could mitigate this concern by understanding why this is happening. And recognizing that it's not a threat to Europe, that this is actually the best thing that could happen to Europe, that we don't need a sick man of Europe. We need a healthy Russia to be a partner with Europe. But we're not capable of that because that requires us to ratchet down the level of hegemony that we enjoy. It means we have to share. We don't like to share, especially when we have it. We stole it from Russia. We brought it in. And now Russia's saying, I want it back. But we don't want to share it. We don't want to give it back. So that's why there's this deep-seated resentment in the West towards Vladimir Putin.
I thought it was simply that the Clintons and the foreign policy establishment wanted NATO in Russia. They wanted Russia to be a part of NATO ultimately, and that Putin wouldn't play that game, and that's why they need to remove him. Is that wrong?
Just the opposite. Okay. When the Soviet Union or when Germany reunited and people need to remember that Germany once was a disgusting, hateful nation under Adolf Hitler, and that the world went to war to destroy it, to defeat it. And Germany was occupied, broken into a Western half and an Eastern half. Today we have this sort of romanticized vision of Germany. It's some sort of this nice Munich beer hall. They drink beer, they do little Lederhosen dances and all that. Germany was where evil was born, raised, nurtured, and grew into this horrible adult. Germany never really paid the price it needed to pay. One of the things that was talked about at the end of the Second World War was denying Germany the ability to reconstitute its industrial capacity. Because when you combine industrial capacity with German nationalism, you get some problems. Now, we felt that because Germany was divided in the East and West, that we could avoid this. The other thing what people wanted to avoid was the militarization of Germany. That's why, even though we allowed the West German military to build up a military as part of NATO, one of the constitutional elements was that military couldn't deploy outside of German soil. Somehow we forgot about this when Germany was reunified. Well, the Russians did. They reminded us that they had 450,000 troops in East Germany for a reason, because it was a defeated nation. And before you reunify Germany, you better have a plan about what's going to happen when Germany becomes one, this giant industrial nation in the center of Europe with a military. What do you do? So the Russians said, you can't move the military east of the current borders, meaning that Germany can be reunified, but NATO can't expand into East Germany. And everybody went, yeah, not one inch eastward. Then under Clinton, we lied.
Right.
Expanded NATO. Meanwhile, the Warsaw Pact dissolved. And now what happened in the Warsaw Pact is you have these broken nations, and Europe was very worried about instability along the lines of what we saw with Yugoslavia. When Yugoslavia broke up, fighting in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Croatia and Serbia, etc. So how do you keep instability from breaking out in former Soviet blocs? You use NATO as a vehicle of stability, of engendering stability. But as you absorb these nations, you absorb their outlook and their ideology. Poland, for instance, is very anti-Russian. The Baltic states, very anti-Russian. So we absorb them. And you know who saw this and was uncomfortable? Not Bill Clinton. Putin. Putin gave an address where he said, I'm going to tell you something I haven't told anybody before. He said, in 2001, before, while Clinton was still president, before Bush became president, so it was 2000, I guess, he met with Clinton, And he said, hey, you know, you're doing all this expansion of NATO and stuff. Why don't you just invite us in?
Oh.
Let us be a member. And that way nobody has to be threatened because we're all part of the same club.
Wow.
And Clinton said no.
Right.
Clinton
right.
said no. So it wasn't that Clinton wanted, wanted Russia and NATO. Russia wanted to be part of NATO. And NATO said no, because NATO can't exist without Russia. NATO needs an enemy. And that enemy's name is Russia.
Fascinating. I had forgotten that he had asked for inclusion in NATO. That's right. Yeah. And what they've had to do over the last 8 years or so is demonize Putin, convince, you know, housewives who watch MSNBC that to hate Putin just as much as they love Black Lives Matter. And to do that, I noticed that they deployed the homophobia thing early on. That was the first way in which they smeared Putin to get, because otherwise your typical Americans watching cable news don't care about stuff except that kind of thing. When they find out that you have a characterological flaw, that you hate people, that you're a bigot, et cetera, then they can get behind hating you and supporting a war against you. I thought that was fascinating. But that's, so they need, you're saying that they need the enemy of Russia to justify their own existence, NATO.
The, Lord Ismay, a British general, was the first Secretary General of NATO. And when he was asked, you know, how would you define NATO? He said the mission of NATO is to keep the Germans down, the Russians out, and the Americans in. And that's what you need. Look, the United States isn't stupid. Without, you know, trying to say glorious things about our former president, you know, Donald Trump touched a nerve. In a good way and a bad way, but
yeah.
You know, when he said, "What is NATO?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we part of this thing? It's lived it past its usefulness. Soviet Union's no more. Why is it here? And why should I pay for it?
Right.
Why am I paying for it?" And a lot of Americans went, "Yeah, why?" Yeah. And now we come to the crux of the thing. Keep America in. NATO can't work without the United States. European unity is a joke. There is no European unity. The United States is the glue that holds Europe together. It is as simple as that. You remove the United States from the process and Europe will collapse like a house of cards. That doesn't mean they're going to go to war with each other, but they will start. Because right now, there's no doubt when you look at NATO, who the top dog is. There's literally no debate. It's the United States.
Of course.
Nothing happens in NATO without the United States wanting it to happen.
Right.
So you remove the United States from NATO, and now immediately you're going to go into three directions. Got the British, who frankly nowadays are just a mid-sized economy with a military that's a joke. So irrelevant. Nobody cares. So much so that when the British Minister of Defense visited Croatia recently, the Croatian Prime Minister said, "I'm not going to meet him." I mean, he's got his army's nothing, and they're no longer part of the European Union. So I'm not meeting them. So he left the British Minister of Defense standing there twirling his thumbs. But you know, then you have France and Germany, which have two totally opposite views on how Europe should function. Right. You know, France wants free spending, liberal democracy. The Germans want more conservative banker type economy. And you see the fight they had with Greece trying to, you know, buy out the, you know, get the Greeks on the road to economic recovery, and the debates that were happening there. Without the United States, is say the you know, the rods that go into the reactor, Europe would go critical mass and blow up. So you got to keep America in. America is not going to stay in NATO to keep the French and the Germans happy. America is going to stay in NATO if you define a threat worthy of the effort. And the only threat in Europe worthy of the effort is the Russian threat. So we had to make Russia an enemy. And we've been trying real hard to do just that. Even if the Russians don't want to be our enemy, we've made them our enemy.
What does the U.S. want from this war? I have heard some people suggest that they want a prolonged war to hurt Russia, to bleed Putin. Is this your take on it?
First of all, I don't believe anybody in power thought Russia would invade. Not until the very end.
That's right.
So therefore, we have to give minimal attention to those who were seeking to make Ukraine the second Afghanistan. Because it can't be a second Afghanistan if you don't think the Russians are going to invade.
Right.
Everybody's jumping onto that now. Now you see a lot of people trying to redefine what America should be getting from Ukraine. And so they're rapidly saying, well, let's turn it into a second Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But that's a knee-jerk reaction as opposed to a real long-term. We were looking to make Ukraine part of NATO, and in doing so, so overextending Russian military spending that Russia would repeat the errors of the Soviet Union, spend itself to death and collapse. Because okay. Our goal in Russia is regime change. We are doing everything possible to create the conditions inside Russia for the Russian voter to vote Vladimir Putin out of office, or for the Russian electorate to rise up through color revolution type demonstrations and push him out, or to create so many economic difficulties that Putin's inner circle turns on him and throws him out. But the goal of the United States is to get rid of Vladimir Putin. That's what we were hoping to achieve, and that's what we're trying to achieve now. The thinking now is that if we can turn Ukraine into a tar baby with Russia in there stuck, can't get out, bleeding resources, economic collapsing around, that Putin won't be long for this political world, that his time in office will reach its end. And that's our goal. That's why we continue to pour in, hundreds of millions of dollars of military assistance, even though any rational actor knows this war is over. This war is all you're doing is irritating the Russians, and the Russians have said so. It said, it appears the only thing you want to do is kill Russians and kill Ukrainians while you're at it. But you're not going to change the outcome. But Russia has put a, they sent a demarche yesterday, I believe, where they said, stop sending the weapons or we're going to have to do things to make it more difficult for you to send weapons. But our goal right now is to lengthen this thing to make it a military disaster and therefore a political disaster for Vladimir Putin.
So I'm a little confused about something. So you made a compelling argument that the West and the United States in particular needs a strong and maybe obstinate Russia to justify the existence of NATO and to justify U.S. involvement with NATO. But then you're also saying that they want regime change. They want to get rid of Putin, get rid of the strong man, get rid of strong Russia. So I don't know why they would want regime change if they also need a strong and offensive Russia.
When did NATO begin expanding? In the 1990s.
Right.
Who was the president of Russia? Boris Yeltsin.
Right.
The epitome of the weak Russian leader. Okay, NATO will thrive on a weak Russia. But in order to talk about expanding NATO today, militarily and stuff, you need a strong Russia. So, and when you're going to confront somebody, you don't confront to lose. You confront to win. You have an objective. Believe me, this wouldn't be the first time that NATO had to sit back and redefine itself. But if NATO succeeded in getting rid of Vladimir Putin, then NATO would sit back and redefine itself. This is why you saw NATO in search of enemies in the early 2000s. That's why they went to Libya. What role does NATO play in Libya? None. But apparently they do. That's why they went to Afghanistan. Why does a North Atlantic Treaty Organization have to be in Afghanistan? What were they doing in Iraq? How come NATO had a presence in the Persian Gulf? Why is NATO, prior to this war, talking about establishing a presence in the Pacific? Because NATO is an organization that, in order to survive as an organization, must be continuously in search of enemies. Right now, Vladimir Putin is their enemy. If they can defeat Vladimir Putin, they're going to be looking to China as their enemy. They're going to be finding new enemies because NATO is a military alliance who can only justify its existence if it has a threat that can compel people to continue to fund the military to the levels necessary to keep this alliance viable.
Are you tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet? Maybe advertisers know a bit too much about you, or you're concerned about the privacy of your identity. Using incognito mode, unfortunately, won't solve the problem. But IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish helps you safely browse the internet without exposing your private details to third parties such as hackers, your ISP, or advertisers. You can use IPVanish on your computers, tablets, phones, even devices like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. When you use IPVanish, all of your data is encrypted. This means that your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be completely shielded from falling into the wrong hands. Even your physical location will be hidden. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It's that simple. You can use IPVanish on unlimited devices without sacrificing on speed. Your computers, tablets, phones, even devices like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. Whether I'm at home or in public, I don't go online anymore without using IPVanish. IPVanish is offering an incredible 70% off their yearly plan for our listeners with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's just like getting 9 months for free. IPVanish is super easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're instantly protected. You won't even know it's on. Stop sharing with the world everything you watch, everything you search for, and everything you buy. Take your privacy back today with the brand rated 4.6 out of 5 on Trustpilot. So go to ipvanish.com/thad and use promotional code THAD and claim your 70% savings. That's ipvanish.com/thad. But don't the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Clinton Foundation all want Russia to be part of NATO? Isn't that their ultimate objective? It seems to me that that would be the time when they pop the champagne and really celebrate when they have Russia in the fold.
Nobody wants Russia to be part of NATO. There's okay. not a single serious player out there right now that's asking Russia to be part of NATO. Russia, okay. Putin may have made the offer, but I think Putin made the offer to join NATO knowing the answer he was going to get, but because it would be problematic for Russia as well, because Russia isn't a European country. It has part of its country in Europe, but Russia is a Eurasian country. They stretch all the way out to the Pacific. And so, Russia's problems are not NATO's problems. But nobody wants Russia to be part of NATO, no NATO country, because Russia would dominate NATO. It's the biggest country in the world.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I had always thought just the opposite. I'd always assumed that that's what the Clintons wanted, and that's why they went hard on expanding NATO eastward. But that makes sense to me, the necessity of an enemy, for sure. Yeah. It sounds like you are somewhat sympathetic to the Russian side in this conflict. Is that right?
Let me answer it this way, first of all. Mm-hmm. I didn't want a war. And I'm not happy there is a war, mm-hmm. because this war has brought about untold suffering to the people of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. There are millions of refugees. There are millions of people displaced. There are thousands of dead, tens of thousands of dead, perhaps. So to say that I'm sympathetic to the Russian cause would somehow imply that I think this war is a good war. Mm-hmm. I don't. I think this war could have been avoided, should have been avoided. But I put the blame more on NATO and Ukraine than I do on Russia. Does Russia have some fault? Yes. But I mean, how long do you ask a country to back up? And at one point in time, when they hit the brick wall and there's no room to go backwards, do you accept that they can't continue to move it? Russia did everything possible to avoid this war. So they went to war. Now, having said that, then, if this war becomes a tragic inevitability, then you have to look at why is this war being fought? If this war was being fought to destroy Ukraine, I couldn't support it. I couldn't support it. I couldn't say, okay. If this war was being fought to recreate the Soviet Union, I couldn't support it. Mm. This war is being fought to guarantee the permanent neutrality of Ukraine. I support that. I understand the Russian position. This war is being fought to destroy the odious ideology of Banderism, Nazism. You sign me up. I'm sorry. No, I don't have any sympathy for these people. My country went to war against their ideological forefathers. I thought we had won that war. Apparently we hadn't. And Russia is in the business of killing Nazis, and the business is good right now. And I know that's not a very humanistic thing to say, but I don't view the Nazis as humans. So, sorry. The demilitarization, you know, that's hand in glove with neutrality. You can't make the Ukrainian military a proxy of NATO and pretend that you haven't de facto expanded NATO into Ukraine. So I think Russia has every right to ask the Ukrainian military to be restructured in a manner that it doesn't have, you know, a NATO influence. Russia wanted to do this peacefully. They've been forced to do it other ways. The war has changed, too, because of the heavy fighting. I think Russia has been compelled to reexamine its what the outcome is going to be. And I don't mean that Russia's backing off. Russia's winning this war, but they've lost too many men, and the Ukrainian government has harmed too many Russians to ever allow the Russian-speaking territories to be governed by Ukrainians again. Where I think Putin would have been accepted early on, the Crimea being permanently Russian and Donetsk and Lugansk having independent status, maybe to renegotiate their entry back into Ukraine at some future date. Those days are over. I think now we're looking at the creation of more independent Russian states within Ukraine that will eventually, I think, unify into something called Novaya Russia. And it'll be a new Russian state within Russia. And Ukraine brought it on itself. How far this dismantling goes, I don't know. What's going to happen to Western Ukraine? What's going to happen to the areas of Ukraine that have primarily Hungarian-speaking population or Romanian-speaking population? If Russia starts carving out the Russian-speaking population, will other people make a play? And what will be left? And normally, I would say this is unacceptable. This is totally unacceptable. Except, I think the Ukrainian government has lost the right to exist. And just like Nazi Germany lost the right to exist in its current form. You know, at the end of World War II, we carved Germany up. People tend to forget that we gave away Silesia to the Poles. We gave away Prussia to the Poles and to the Russians. And the reason why is that we couldn't have a Danzig corridor like there was after World War I. There couldn't be separate because the Germans would always want to march east to reunify their territory. So they permanently took it away from them. And I think this Ukrainian nationalism is just as odious as the German nationalism gave birth to the Nazi ideology. And I think that Russia is going to have to come up with a solution to Ukraine that's going to make Ukraine look far different than what it looked like before this war started. And again, Zelensky could have stopped this simply by saying, I won't join NATO. Right there, this war would never have happened.
Wow. How many casualties do you think there have been?
Well, the Russians, you know, again, you'll never know this by the Western media. Let me put it this way. Just about everything put out by the Ukrainian government has been proven to be a lie. But it's part and parcel of an overall information warfare campaign being waged by the Ukrainian government in concert with the United States, Great Britain, with the full complicity of the Western media. I mean, you know, how do the Ukrainians fire a missile, Tochka-U? It hits a train station, kills over 50 people, and they blame it on the Russians. Russians don't own that missile. The missile came from Ukrainian territory in the vicinity of where the only brigade that operates this missile operates. But somehow the Ukrainians went, no, it was the Russians, without any evidence, any proof. And the media repeats it. No, it was a Ukrainian missile that was fired. It was an old missile. Its maintenance was probably questionable and it probably malfunctioned. And that's why it fell short and hit the train station. Why can't the Ukrainian government just say, yep, that was us, it was an accident, boom. Everything that happens has to be spun so it puts Russia in a bad light. The Russians, meanwhile, everything they've said has turned out to be accurate and truthful. So I believe the Russians claim that they can document over 23,000 Ukrainian dead.
Oh my God.
And they have published some of these documents that are captured documents. At the Battle of Mariupol alone, I think the Ukrainians started with 14,000 defenders. The Russians have captured close to 2,100. The Ukrainians claim that there were 4,000 left in the center. A couple thousand might have been evacuated because they're wounded, but that leaves 4,000 or 5,000 dead. Zelensky just came out and said, "Oh, the most we've suffered is 2,000 to 3,000 dead total." We know that at least 4,000 to 5,000 Ukrainians have died in Mariupol, told you. So we know Zelensky's lying. And we also know that the rest of the Ukrainian military has suffered massive casualties. So, at the end of the day, we won't know until the war is over and all the data is put out there. And, the victor goes the narrative. I believe Russia's going to win. And I think Russia will be in control of that because the proof won't be on the battlefield. You can only lie right now as long as the media allows you to lie. But when Russia wins this war and has control of flow of information, I think Russia will be able to document the horrific cost of this war to both sides. Both sides have suffered death and destruction, the likes of which no nation in modern times has suffered the equivalent of, except maybe the Iraqis and the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war and in the 1980s, they suffered significant casualties. But in terms of Europe, no European country has suffered these kinds of losses since World War II.
Is this worse than the war in Chechnya?
Chechnya was a very limited war. But I think that the Chechen conflict, it was also a different conflict. A lot of people call it, a Russian versus Chechen conflict. But the Chechen conflict was actually a civil war between rival clans, Chechen clans, some who were against the Russians, some who fought for the Russians. And we saw that the pro-Russian clans won. That's why you have Kadyrov today in charge. But if it was a Russia versus Chechen, then you wouldn't have Kadyrov being the president. You wouldn't have Chechen troops fighting alongside the Russians in Ukraine today. But I think the battle for Grozny was an example of what happens when modern cities meet modern weaponry. We're seeing that in Mariupol. But ask yourself, what other Ukrainian city has suffered like Mariupol? None. Why? Because the Russians aren't in the business of destroying cities. They're in the business of destroying the Ukrainian military and achieving denazification. If they were in the business of destroying Ukrainian cities, why is it they continue to allow President Zelensky to give interviews? Why can he speak to Congress, to Congress, to the parliament, et cetera, and get hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid? It would be in Russia's interest to shut that down, but they're not, because this is a special military operation, not war.
They want to keep Zelensky alive, you think?
If they didn't want him alive, he'd be dead. That simple. He's the easiest man in the world to kill.
Why? Why do they want him alive?
Well, I think the more this drags on, the less utility he has. So Zelensky should be careful because Putin's already said there's going to be no negotiation. So that takes away some of Zelensky's value. But, again, we come down. Why would the Russians let a man who was 23% popularity before this war began? That's Zelensky, who, the great Democrat had arrested all of his political opposition and shut down all of the opposition press, Mr. Democracy. And in order to survive, had to double down on going to bed with the Nazis, had to meet with them, give them medals for heroism, and bring them into his government to keep himself viable. Russia should have just let this man stew in his own juice, and the Nazis would have killed him. But instead, the Russians allowed him to become this larger-than-life character. He's now the Winston Churchill of Ukraine. He's the Abraham Lincoln of Ukraine. He's the George Washington of Ukraine. I mean, You say it. He is it. King Leonidas in the 300. That's him. I mean, why would Russia want this? And the answer is simple. Because there will be a surrender. There will be a surrender document. And there will be surrender terms. Do you have a failed 23% president sign that document? Or do you have Winston Churchill sign that document? Which one brings more credibility to the terms? I think Russia has allowed Zelensky to be elevated to the status that whatever peace comes out of this will be a peace that Europe must accept because Winston Churchill said it was okay.
That would be brilliant on Putin's part if that's what he's thinking. Yes. The media in this country and across the West, I believe, has been telling me consistently since the beginning of the conflict in February that the conflict began in, there is no history. The conflict began in February with the Russian invasion because, according to them, it was a quote, and this is the word that's used, an unprovoked attack. What's your answer to that? And you can take it back to 2014 or you can take it back further if you want. But, you know, this is what they are all saying to us every day. It was an unprovoked attack.
Well, I mean, we've already talked about Maidan and the elevation of the militant right into a militarized group. What people, a lot of people don't realize is after Maidan, the radical nationalists got the Ukrainian parliament to pass some laws that banned the Russian language and limited what it meant to be Russian. Because remember, it's about Ukrainian purity. And so the Russians, of course, were appalled by the Russian citizens of Ukraine, the Russian speakers. Ethnic Russians. The Nazis went down to Odessa in May of 2014, and there were counter demonstrations that got violent. They ended up gathering up 150 Russian protesters, and they jammed them into a government home. It's not the House of Culture, but it's, you know, it's an official structure, and set it on fire.
Yeah.
Close to 50 people burned to death. Russians. All of the Russian people are watching this going, what's going on? They ran through the streets beating Russians. Then they tried to make a move on Crimea, and that's when the little green men came in. And Putin said, nope, Crimea's ours. We're sorry. So that's when they moved up to the Donbass. They set up in Mariupol. That's where Azov Battalion was born, because Mariupol is on the Sea of Azov. So it became the Azov Battalion because the ideology isn't natural to the East. The ideology comes from Lvov in the West. But the Azov Battalion set up Nazi Central in Mariupol and began the frontal assault on the Russians in the Donbass.
Okay.
And the Russians rose up. The Russian speakers rose up. They said, no more. The Ukrainian army was sent in, and now we have a near civil war that with the Russian government providing some weapons, and they're fighting. From 2014 to 2022, 8 years, incessant warfare, nonstop. The root cause of which is, of course, the Ukrainian nationalists seeking to ban, purify Ukraine of Russian influence. Now, Viktor Poroshenko, the president before Zelensky, gave a speech, a famous speech, where he, or infamous speech, depending on your point of view, where he shouted out. He said, if you're an Ukraine, if in the Donbass, if you're an Ukrainian child, you will go to kindergarten. You will play in the playground. You will come home at night and eat dinner with your family. If you are a Russian, you will live in fear in the basement because we will shell you every single day. Now, the world can sit there and go, if you're a Russian living in Donbass, meant that your children were terrorized for 8 years. Now we come back. We talked about Putin's speech. Remember the one about the Soviet Union collapsing? But the greatest tragedy was Russia. Vladimir Putin's a president that promised that he would defend all Russians. So what's happening in Donbass is problematic for him. He tried to get a peaceful solution, the Minsk Accords. But both Poroshenko and Zelensky were told by Azov that they would be killed if they implemented the Minsk Accords. So there was no hope for ending the fighting. And indeed, it was just the opposite. Zelensky said, we're going to recapture Donbass ourselves. So he built up in his own words, he said it's the finest soldiers in the Ukrainian army were concentrated in the Donbas. And the Russians say that's because they were preparing to launch an attack to push out the Russians from Donbas to recapture it for Ukraine. So Russia's feeling was that if you're going to defend Russians, end this violence that's going on, you have to preempt this Ukrainian attack. And so that's what Russia has done. The bottom line is Russia has articulated what I believe to be a cognizable case under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, a preemptive self-defense, a collective self-defense. It's a legally sound excuse. Everybody says this is an illegal war of aggression. No, it ain't. You want to know what an illegal war of aggression was? The United States invading Iraq. That was an illegal war of aggression. Russia, on the other hand, has done everything right by the book. They followed the law assiduously. The West isn't smart enough to understand the law that Russia's following because we're so used to the United States just acting any way it wants to. But Russia did everything right, checked off every checkbox, dotted every I, crossed every T in order to justify its military action.
Okay. So do you believe that Ukraine was actually on the verge of attacking Russian territory?
No, they're on the verge of attacking the Donbas, Ukrainian territory.
Right. Russians in the Donbas, Russian people in the Donbas. Right.
But then Russia did something clever. Back in 2014, Lugansk and Donetsk asked to be independent. Mm-hmm. They declared their independence. They asked Russia to recognize this and incorporate them into Russia. And Russia said, no, you're part of Ukraine. He said, we will fight for your rights to have your language, your culture, and to live as Russians, Russian speakers. But you are part of Ukraine. We have to respect that sovereignty. Now, if they kept that position, Russia would have no legitimate reason to attack Ukraine because this is an internal Ukrainian problem. So in order to justify this, Russia recognized the independence of these two countries and made them independent mm-hmm. states. So now it's not an internal Ukrainian problem. It's a Ukraine versus two independent states who have asked Russia to come to their assistance. Mm-hmm. And that's where Article 51, preemptive collective self-defense comes in. So even though Ukraine isn't attacking Russia, they are attacking an independent state that's part of a collective security agreement that Russia plays a role in, and Russia is defending them.
Okay. Now, what do you think are they going to take Kiev? Is Russia going to take Kiev? Are they going to take the whole country? What are you predicting here?
Well, I don't think Russia wants to take Kiev because, again, it's a city of 3.1 million. I believe Kiev will surrender. I can't speak for Putin. I don't know what the pain tolerance is. What I can say is that the Russians have said they are going to denazify Ukraine. And to me, you can't denazify Ukraine until you've captured Lvov, until you've put high explosives on the statue of Stepan Bandera and blow it up, and until you ensure that Kiev changes its constitution and its legislation, outlawing the Bandera movement forever, making Stepan Bandera as illegal to celebrate in Ukraine as Adolf Hitler is as illegal to celebrate in Germany. Now, Russia has mobilized 60,000 reserves. These aren't frontline troops. They're not coming in to fight. These are troops that are more conducive to rear area security, which tells me that once Russia defeats the main forces in Donbas, that they will make a move on Odessa, and then they will make a move on Lvov. Okay. And the 60,000 troops will guard the rear area while what's left of the 200,000 troops finishes the job. I can't imagine any scenario that doesn't involve Russia physically terminating the political parties that gave birth to the Azov Battalion that glorify Stepan Bandera. And you can't do that by long distance. You do that the Russian way, which is they have lists of names. They're going to go in. They're going to capture them. If they resist, they're going to kill them. It's that easy because Nazis don't deserve to live a normal life. They either die, they're found guilty, and they repent. And then whatever restorative justice Russia is willing to. Remember, Russia released, Nazis, some of the hardcore Nazis 10 years after World War II ended. Many of these guys were captured in 1945 and Russia kept them in prison until 1955. Then they were allowed to return home. So it's not hopeless. But the point is, I don't think this campaign ends without some sort of conclusive resolution to the problem of the Bandera movement in Ukraine.
They're going to go round up all the Nazis and kill them.
Kill them or capture them.
That's a grim business.
They chose it. Mm-hmm. When you decide to dance with the devil, the fires of hell are going to burn you. And I'm not a religious man. I'm just saying that, this is it. And what I don't get is why the average American isn't nodding their head yes at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, for goodness sake, if I put Schindler's List on TV, I'll have people ready to line. You get the average American to watch Saving Private Ryan. And by the time, Tom Hanks has breached the wall and gets up there and his guys are gunning down the Germans, you're like, yeah, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him, because you hate him. And that's just a movie. That's fake. Imagine reality where these pigs are raping on a daily basis and videotaping it and putting it on the internet, where they're saran wrapping people to poles, painting their faces green, sexually abusing them in public, where they murder Russian prisoners of war on tape, torture Russian prisoners of war. This is who they are. This is the real ideology. This is the like a religion of hate. I don't get why Americans aren't saying, yeah. Now, I could understand some distance if we hadn't fought World War II, if we hadn't paid the blood price, if we hadn't gone to total war against Nazi Germany, and we'd just been observers, maybe we wouldn't take it so personal. But we did that. And guess who else takes it personal? The Russians. 23 to 32 million people died in World War II destroying Nazi Germany. You think they're going to let it resurrect itself next door in Ukraine? Never. Never.
That's powerful. Yeah, I've been to the Soviet. I was in the Soviet Union in 1987, and they took us on a tour of some of the military cemeteries and of World War II. And this was just an open field that went to the horizon, in which there were mass graves, each the size of a football field, each with 10,000 bodies in them. And you could see that stretching to the horizon, one football sized field, cemetery after another, after another, after another. It is the World War II runs through the culture of Russia like nothing else. I mean, it is on the top of their mind all the time. And certainly as a state, as a nation state, it's always on the top of the Russian mind, right?
Look, what's the number one holiday in Russia? May 9th, Victory in Europe
right.
Day.
Right, Victory Day, yeah.
Well, Victory Day. When was the last time the United States held a parade on Victory in Europe Day?
Right, we forgot.
We don't. Yeah. We don't. I mean, we may have back in the day when we had a number of war, but now that the guys are dying, out of sight, out of mind. Yep. Guess who's not out of sight, out of mind in Russia? There may not be any veterans left, but the sons and daughters, the grandsons and granddaughters carry the photographs of their relatives who served. And they call themselves the Immortal Regiment. And they parade by the tens of thousands in every city in Russia on May 9th in honor of what happened. Never forget, never forgive. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Never forget and never forgive. The Nazis don't deserve your forgiveness. And that's why we don't get it. That's why Putin is more popular today than ever. That's why the Russians are rallying behind this war. It's not, that they're susceptible to propaganda. It's that this is their life. This is their DNA. This is their blood. And we don't get it here. We're the ignorant ones. We're the ones not understanding what's going on. You can't allow neo-Nazi ideology to resurrect itself in the heart of Europe. You can't. And Russia is making sure that it won't happen. The West may be uncomfortable with it, but believe me, we owe them a great debt of gratitude when this is all done.
Okay, so you see this very clearly as a just war then.
Yeah. I mean, I wish it didn't. I wish there was a way that they could have avoided this conflict. I think had Ukraine chosen perpetual neutrality, and a settlement of the Minsk Accords, that Ukraine might have been able to allow this, because the Nazi ideology can't grow unless there's a festering cesspool of hate. Mm-hmm. This war has given them the hate. That's why you're seeing them taking even more control right now. But if Russia had been able to create a condition of peace, peaceful coexistence, nonviolence, no NATO, no NATO trainers coming in and training the Azov Battalion, there's no longer a reason for the Azov Battalion to exist. Maybe these right wingers could have sunk back into the cesspool from where they came. Even though they would exist, they wouldn't be a dominant force, and that's okay. I wish that had happened, but now that it's happened and this ideology has taken root and moved rapidly throughout all of Ukrainian society, then it's a just war. And the number one justification for this war is the destruction of Nazi ideology.
Hmm. I'm going to have to sit with that for a while and think about it. It's hard for me to accept what you're saying. But
well, I respect that. I mean, I come at it, I have a certain reputation in the American anti-war movement because of my stance on Iraq. If you mistake me for a pacifist,
oh yeah,
you're wrong. If you call me anti-war, no.
Of course.
I hate war. I despise war. But I recognize that the human condition is deeply flawed, and sometimes evil manifests itself in a manner where war is the only solution. And if that's going to happen, you need people like me who have made war their business, war their life. Because war isn't for amateurs. When an amateur crosses the line of departure, they're soon dead. War is for professionals, people who live, breathe it. Hopefully, we can keep them pinned up in a cage and just throw raw meat at them for 20 years while they prepare for war and never have to go to war. But when you need us, you cry havoc and you let loose the dogs of war, because there is a dirty job to be done. And I believe that in Ukraine, there's a dirty job to be done. However, because I have a bias towards violence, I understand that there's other perspectives that may in fact be right. That's the beauty of democracy. See, you and I can sit here and have a civil discussion where we can debate, we can have a dialogue, we can work out these problems so that maybe we can come to a common understanding without any animosity. We need this kind of dialogue here. And it's a shame that the media is not facilitating this. Why is this happening? I mean, I'm glad it's happening now, but why is it happening here? Why isn't this something that's happening in every town hall in America today? Right. Where people can, but you know, if we had a town hall, you know what would happen. Putin lover, you're a shill for Russia. Nazi lover. And it would turn into a shouting match, a screaming match, because America has become more Jerry Springer than Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not anti-war. I mean, you sound to me very much like a Marine still. Are you still a Marine?
Once a Marine, always a Marine. You don't go through that training, that preparation, that experience without it staying with you. I'm also a Marine with bad knees and a little soft in the belly right now, so I know what my limitations are.
But your sort of orientation toward the world and your attitude is very much like a Marine, I would say.
Absolutely. And I recognize that. And that there's some strengths to that, but there's some weaknesses to that, too. It's not an ideal situation. It is what it is.
Yeah. Last question, Scott. And thank you so much for doing this. This has just been amazing. What do you want to happen in the conflict in Ukraine? What do you want to happen with NATO, with Europe and Russia generally? What do you want to see happen in that part of the world now?
I would like to see this war come to an end as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see that no additional conflict emerges. That Europe now is confronted with a reality that compels it to undertake a restructuring of the European security framework so that you can have Russia not feeling threatened by an expansive NATO. I'd like to see the United States disengage from Europe militarily. That doesn't mean that we disengage politically or economically. We have deep roots to Europe. I mean, melting pot of the United States, primarily European in nature. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can never have a divorce, but I would like to see the demilitarization of Europe. And that includes Russia. I'd like to see a de-emphasis on the military solution and a more emphasis on how to peacefully coexist with each other, because, you know, and I don't want to come off as alarmist here, but, you know, there is this thing called climate change that everybody's talking about that represents an existential threat to the world. And one would think that in order to combat it, that you should have countries working together on how to restructure economies so that they are less carbon intensive and more green. You know, that happens best when you're not building militaries and going to war with each other. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would like to see. It would require the United States to accept the uncomfortable reality that we are no longer the world's singular superpower, that the world does not revolve around us. I would like the United States to become a very influential member of the international community, one of the most influential members of the international community. But recognizing that when you sit at the table, it's a round table with nobody at the head, and there's a co-equals around that table as well, Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, other nations as they emerge, and that these nations' rights and desires are taken into account, that it's no longer about, you know, making the world work for the United States. It's about finding a way to make the United States, together with other nations, work on behalf of the world. That's what I would like to see. I'd like to see a world where you don't need a Marine Corps anymore.
Yeah, right.
Where people like Sky Ritter could instead apply, you know, whatever aggressive tendencies I have to maybe firefighting, you know, running into a burning building and rescuing people, or, you know, fighting wildfires or something like that, you know, where you can still be a man, but you don't have to kill. You know, so, you know, that I'm being a little facetious there. But my point is that, you know, right now, you know, we have a Europe on the cusp of continuous warfare. And I tell you, I'll leave you with this thought. There's an election in France on April 24th. And most people look at that election and say, oh, my God, it's Emmanuel Macron or it's Marie Le Pen. And when they say Le Pen, they're thinking right wing. Boom. I'll tell you right now, if Macron is reelected, it'll be a disaster for Europe, an absolute disaster for Europe, because Europe will continue to believe in an expansive NATO and bringing in nations like Finland and Sweden and things of that nature. If Le Pen wins, she will be the savior of Europe and the savior of the world. And that's not because I agree with her ideology. I don't. But I recognize that she will bring an end to this NATO madness. She will say no to bringing in Sweden and Finland. She will say no to continue expansion. And she will say no to continuing to support conflict against Russia. She will make it her priority to repair relations with Russia. And when that happens, this artifice of European unity that Joe Biden has manufactured out of thin air will collapse like the house of cards that it is. And then we can get into the direction of the world that I'd like to see. So wow. I'm pulling for Marine Le Pen like you wouldn't believe. Not because I think she has great ideas. She doesn't. She has the ones that count right now. Mm. The ones that count are the ones that can bring an end to perpetual warfare in Europe.
Fascinating. That surprised me a little bit, although I guess I shouldn't have been too surprised, because you're right. Le Pen would absolutely throw a massive monkey wrench into NATO's plans, right? No doubt about it. The nationalist populist.
That's the greatest threat facing Europe today is NATO.
Wow. Wow. Sounds like you want to end this war, but you also want to finish World War II. Am I right about that?
In a way, nonviolently. You know, World War II is supposed to end with harmony, but instead it turned into the Cold War. I'd like to finish this war and finish the Cold War.
Okay.
I'd like to find a way for Russia and Europe to peacefully coexist and for America to have a realistic role in European affairs without having to be the dominant power in Europe.
Right. But you want to finish Nazism is what I was getting at.
Absolutely.
Right. Which is going to require some force. Right.
Hey, you know, no, not some force. It's going to require a lot of, let's just be blunt. A lot of bad people are going to die. You know, and some people get mad at me when I use this analogy, but, you know, maybe I shouldn't, but I will anyways, because I'm an honest guy. I love dogs. I own three of them. I go to the dog park, and nothing brings more joy to my heart watching all those dogs run around. And I will bend over backwards for a dog, you know, as most dog lovers will. Mm-hmm. But if you got a rabid dog running through the streets, I will gun him down. I will hunt him down. I will kill him without mercy, because he's not a dog anymore. He's a diseased animal. I love humans. I want to peacefully coexist with humans. But Nazi ideology is a diseased ideology, and a human that has absorbed it is a diseased human. And they should be treated like rabid dogs.